Page 118 of The Unfolding is the story of Susie Larson.
I got up from that beating and I heard in my ear, I can get to you anytime, anywhere, and God will never stop me. And so at that moment, I knew God was real and I knew the devil was real. That is when a spirit of fear took up residence in my soul.
God's story has been unfolding.
Since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in the unfolding.
Hi, this is Meredith Foster. Several years ago, I spent an entire summer listening to Susie Larson. That's a slight exaggeration. It actually kind of went like this. Every week, I'd pull the push mower out of the shed, and for the next hour while I mowed the lawn, I was listening to audio from the same speaking engagement over and over all summer long. It was one of the first times I'd heard Susie Larson's story, and I was drawn to this woman who had gained so much wisdom in her life. Susie is an incredible speaker, Bible teacher, author, radio host. A friend of mine once said of Susie, you know, we all want the wisdom of Susie Larson, but we don't necessarily want to live through what she has lived through to gain that wisdom. There are some really tough things in what Susie has experienced, including sexual trauma. So just a word of caution if that might be a trigger for you. Those traumatic experiences left Susie bracing for the next bad thing, living her life in fear.
Well, I was raised in a large family in a church denomination where I really did know God was real. I sensed his presence, but I didn't know Jesus was accessible. I was number 5 of 7 kids. I was a rule follower and kind of people pleaser and pretty sweet as far as I remember. But when I was about 9 years old, I came home from school one day. I had 3 older brothers, 1 older sister, 2 younger sisters. And there was a season of my older brothers' lives where they were hanging around with some creepy friends and kind of getting into things that they ought not. And one particular day, I saw my brother's friend's bikes out in front, and I just wasn't in the mood to see them. My mom wasn't home from work yet. So I went down into the laundry room to get a change of clothes, and I thought I'd just put on my favorite sweatshirt, go up to my room, read a book until my mom got home. And I literally remember having my hands in the dryer, just sorting through, trying to find my sweatshirt. And I heard the laundry door shut behind me, and I turned around and saw several of my brother's friends there. No brother. Now, we lived in a 2-story home. It was kind of Grand Central Station. Kids were coming and going all the time. And so, but just these yucky friends. And I don't really remember how my hands went from being in the dryer to being pinned on the floor, but that is what happened. And I won't get into details, but I will say that sexual trauma took place. And I was so confused about whose fault that was or what exactly happened. And I'd heard mixed messages about when a girl is assaulted, if it's her fault, and just heard different things. So I didn't tell anybody. My dad was a politician in the local city. He was mayor of our city for 27 years. And so appearance mattered, you know, and how things appeared. And I just kind of pictured if I were to say something, the trouble it might cause for us as a family.
So you didn't tell anyone? Not one soul?
I didn't tell anyone until I was about 18 years old.
Oh,
and how that came out was kind of miraculous.
That's such a heavy burden for a kid to carry.
So much. Yeah.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah. So when I got up from that trauma, I really didn't know what to do with it. I really didn't know whose fault it was, but I do know it changed me forever because it opened up this canyon of self-hatred and insecurity. I kind of stopped sleeping through the night. I had a lot of fear. And I had a good family. We had a loving family. They had dysfunction like everybody else in different ways. But, you know, that changed things for me. And I remember about a year later, about 10 years old, I was coming home from school. And I saw those wretched bikes out front. And I remember saying out loud, which shows you how confused my little brain was, but I said, I don't care if God made me this way. Those boys will never touch me again. So I decided to kill time and walk around the baseball diamond, just waiting for my mom's car to pull in. And a different group of boys were in the dugout, and all I heard was, get her! And they were apparently high on something because they ran me down, knocked me to the ground, and beat me really bad. And they were laughing wildly as they kicked me in the stomach, punched me in the face, pulled fistfuls of hair out. And I remember seeing this kind of crazed look in their eye that they were just you know, beating up this little girl for sport. And I'm screaming and crying and curled in a ball and getting just pummeled by these boys. And when they were done with me, they kind of pushed off of me and laughed. Like, can you believe that? As they walked away. And I had scratches on my face and a fat lip and sore ribs and snarled hair. And I got up from that beating, and I heard in my ear, not audibly, but might as well have been, I heard in my ear, I can get to you anytime, anywhere, and God will never stop me. And so at that moment, I knew God was real, and I knew the devil was real. Mm-hmm. And that is when literally a spirit of fear took up residence in my soul. And I will tell you, to this day, I battle fear. I've come so far, but I don't want you to think I'm fearless. I am not a sissy. I am a fighter, and through so much of what I've walked through has made me a fighter. But I probably started out a sissy because I was a people pleaser, and I didn't want to make waves and those kinds of things. But, you know, I came home battered, and so my family did know about that trauma. So the attention I got for that, I sort of put on my other wound as well. So that really kind of set the stage. And what I often say when I'm speaking about those experiences as a young girl is that, you know, I say to women when I'm speaking at conferences, the devil sees your potential long before you ever do. And I believe that's absolutely true. He sees the threat that you will be to him. And so I want you to know that, you know, his threat to you is very connected to your threat to him. So all you got to do is look back to your childhood, the first moments you knew you weren't enough, the first moments you felt like there was maybe someone who had you in their crosshairs. You just look at the threat against you. You know, I've heard, you know, brilliant scholars say that they were tempted to mess their brain up with drugs. You know, I heard, you know, it's like, or someone else who was speaking on identity and the enemy just luring them into a lifestyle of promiscuity, where it's like you look at the temptation or you look at the assault, you can so often see the intersection of your calling and your threat to the enemy. So I'll say that, you know, once I got into middle school, because I had a decent athletic ability, and was a performer, so to speak. I, you know, became a gymnast. I sang in the choir. I volunteered in the office. And, you know, there were multiple reasons for doing that. One was I was trying to dig myself out of a hole that I believed myself to be in. Mm-hmm. But also wanted to stay busy after school. Until, so once I got home, my parents would be home, and I just felt like I was, that was a better scenario for me. And but it helped me feel better about myself, you know, just performing decent, you know, on the gymnastics mat and on the balance beam and all of that. And I would say it was about eighth grade, and I was going to a sleepover, and I had a really close relationship with my mom. She was amazing to be a mother of seven kids and make us each feel so loved, so seen, so special. We had a great relationship. I felt like I was harboring a deep secret that, you know, every once in a while I would feel like I need to tell her. And even though I didn't know what, even how to frame what had happened in that laundry room, I felt bad that I was keeping something from her. Mm-hmm. But there was one day I was walking out the door to go to this sleepover slumber party, and my mom teasingly said, "Now don't sneak out and meet boys." And well, see, in middle school, I was too busy for boys, so to speak, because I was terrified at the thought of having a boyfriend. And and so I stopped in my tracks, and I almost turned around to say, "Let me tell you why that's the last thing that I would ever do." You know, I was so close to telling her, but I thought, I'll destroy the relationship forever, you know? Mm. I wish so bad I would have, but I just didn't know enough to know how to frame that experience. So I stopped and I just said, "Mom, you know, I won't." And so I'm at the slumber party, and we do what girls do. I mean, this dates me, but we danced to Beach Boys. And we ate Doritos, and, you know, we did our little slumber party sleepover stuff. But later on in the evening, the girls decided to sneak out to meet boys, and I felt like I was going to throw up. I mean, you know, to put yourself in that danger, sneak out at night, I just, you know, I couldn't do it. And so I stayed back with the two girls who smoked. I just thought that was the better choice, don't you? I didn't inhale. I didn't smoke, I promise you. But they didn't want anything to do with me either. And they are sitting in their sleeping bag. And they went to the local Catholic parochial school. And so they were mocking what the nun had taught in class that day. They're like, because she was talking about end times in Revelation. So they're like, oh, as if, and they were talking about end time signs, you know, of things that are going to happen and that these seals are going to open up and these, you know, locusts are going to come out of the, you know, whatever. And they're like, as if that's really going to happen. But I had never heard anything like that before. And so something like quickened within me. And so I was by myself on the other side of the basement, sitting by myself in my sleeping bag, because I'm listening to these two girls talk who had no interest in me whatsoever. But something just sort of, you know, compelled. Well, it was the Holy Spirit. You know, I went out and sat on the picnic table and I looked up in the stars and I said, God, I know you're real. But if there's more to you than what I know, would you reveal yourself to me? And this is no lie what I said. I'm going to start reading the Bible. I think it's kind of boring, but if you can snazz it up, we got a deal. And I like to say I was in on a technicality because I always picture God just rubbing his, you know, temples going, well, we kind of got to take her. I mean, she snuck in there, you know, that prayer. But anyway, just because of the particular denomination that I was in, it wasn't looked too kindly upon to read the Bible on your own. And so I was reading the Bible under my bedsheet with a flashlight. And I literally fell in love with Jesus. I fell in love with him. And I knew I was the worst sinner of them all. And so I asked him, you know, to be my Savior 1,000 times without anybody leading me to the Lord. It was just the Spirit of God just showing up in those Gospels. And then I'd read the Proverbs and read the Psalms and other parts that, you know, didn't make sense to me. But I just became kind of a covert Christian.
So what was it about him that you fell in love with? Do you remember what it was?
Oh, yes. I mean, that he was for the underdog. Everywhere you turn, he was sticking up for the person that the world discarded. You know, the person at the bottom of the pile. And I was her. I was the Samaritan woman. You know, I was the woman dragged before Jesus that everybody wanted to stone. I was her. And that he would be the way he was with women, you know, made him wonderful to me. I wanted to know him. No one ever asked me that, so you caught me off guard.
Oh, sorry. But yeah. I just wondered, because that's such a... You know, some people pick up the Bible and, again, it just feels boring and dry. But your heart and your spirit was primed for his love.
Yeah. Exactly. And a funny story. So when I think I was 9th grade, I heard about a Bible study in the next city, next community. And so I went by myself. And this is back in the, I want to say, when was this, late 70s? So this is when, like, you know, crew cuts and Izod, you know, the preppy look was very big. Uh-huh. And so this guy that was teaching would fit now. I mean, he was wearing flip-flops, T-shirts, and a long beard and long hair before anybody else was. So he looked like Jesus to me, first of all. And he unpacked the Word of God. Like, I would sit at his feet, you know, and it was so interesting because everybody around me had this kind of rough-edged kind of goth look to them. And I'm sitting there with my little letter jacket and they're like, do you want to go out for a smoke? And I'm like, no, I'm good. You know, and I mean, I just was all by myself listening. And I find out years later, because he ends up being one of the pastors on the staff of the church that I ended up attending years later as a wife and mother. And he got up and said he started out in a nonprofit ministry for at-risk youth. And I'm standing in with him and my husband and my three little boys. I'm like, at-risk youth? And he goes, I was wondering how long it would take for the light bulb to go on for you. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, I never wanted to ask you what you were doing there because you stuck out like a sore thumb, but you showed up. So I just thought, welcome, you know. But I had no idea that his ministry was, I guess I was an at-risk youth. But
didn't know it.
I didn't know it. Mm-hmm. And but he was the one. So he loaned me a cassette tape, again, to date me, but of Howie Hendrix. And it was so life-giving and amazing. I could not get enough of biblical teaching. And so I'm listening to this. And he needed it back by, let's say, Monday. Now, I'm a family with a family of seven. There was multiple siblings that were drivers. And we only had my mom's car and my dad's car. I couldn't get the car on Monday to bring it back. And so I got there Wednesday. And I had so much shame. So much shame that I couldn't look at him. And I couldn't look at him. I was on his doorstep and I looked down and I handed it over and I was like, I couldn't look at him. He was looking at me. I'm like, I was supposed to be here Monday. I'm so, so sorry. And he said, come into my office. I need to talk with you. So I sat down and he goes, who touched you? I'm like, what? And he says, who put their hands on you? Oh. I'm like, I don't know what you mean. And he said, nobody has that kind of shame unless they've been assaulted. And then he said, let me get a little more graphic. And he said something, and I started to dry heave and guttural sob and hold my stomach and go. And he said, Susie, what happened to you wasn't right, and it wasn't your fault. So I want you to go home and write in detail what happened. And if it doesn't rip your guts out, you weren't honest enough with me. Mm. We're going to get through this. And I was 18 at this point.
Wow.
And he met with me once a month. And here again, I don't know why he's putting time into me. You know, I didn't know that he was in a ministry. You know, he was getting support from parents whose kids are really, you know, on the rough edges. And he was just pouring into me. And I remember one point when I was in my first or second year of college, and I was dating a guy, and he says, him or me? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, you have more talent and gifting in your pinky than I do in my whole body. But if you're going to waste your time with him, I'm not going to waste my time with you.
Oh, my goodness. Had you ever had somebody be that direct with you?
No. Yeah. And I said, you, I pick you. And I broke up with this guy. But, for him to call out of me, the gifts of God in me, I can't even tell you. And to put time into me, I don't even know why he did that. But I was so fractured and wounded, I didn't know enough to even question it too much. It was just a lifeline for me. And so that is sort of the foundation of my faith journey to begin with. And when I finally, came clean about not only my faith with my parents to say, I'm a Christian and I want to run after Jesus, and I, with all due respect, I can't stay in this denomination. I can't. I want to honor you, but I've got to chase him. And, I'm 18 at this point and had to be honest about what happened. And that's another story that I'd actually rather not tell. But my parents were wonderful and released me to run after the Lord. And so, yeah, there's been some real trauma in my backstory, and there's more there than I'm sharing, but that really was a foundation for me to fall in love with God's word, to really, really grasp the fact that Emmanuel, he is with us. He delights in every detail of our lives. And I wish I could remember the reference, but one of my passages that I think of often is in the Psalms. It says, he heals up the brokenhearted. He binds up their wounds. He put the stars in place and calls them each by name. And it shows the smallness of his hand and the vastness of his hand, that he knows our story. He knows the lies we picked up when life let us down. He knows the broken places, and he's so careful with those. And yet he's so majestic and powerful that he knows every single star and every galaxy because he put them there. And that he would be so gentle with our story and yet so powerful in the universe. I mean, I always say, God has no rival. He's the only uncreated being, so he could be any way he wants. And he's kind, and he's good, and he's accessible. And there's a wrathful side, and he's wrathful against all the violence and the wickedness and the sin that destroys the vulnerable, the hurting, and the broken. I mean, he's a good God.
As God was healing the wounds of Susie's past, he was also preparing her for hardship ahead. Part two of Susie's story is coming up. But first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute.
Hi, I'm Habib Habib. As a younger person, I would have never imagined that I was tough enough to handle the challenges that life threw at me. But I was wrong. By the grace of God, I managed through all of it. That taught me a lesson that we are stronger than we think and able to handle more than we think. Brianna Weiss said, "One day, the mountain that's in front of you will be so far behind you, it will barely be visible in the distance. But the person you have become in learning to get over it, that will stay with you forever. And that's the point of the mountain." 2 Timothy 1 says that God gives us a spirit of power. In looking back at my life, me, a timid teenager who was afraid of his own tail, I can testify that that verse is true. You never know how strong you are until being strong is the only choice you have. Just then, God gives you the spirit of power to be resilient and to get through the difficult times. My prayer for you is that you believe it too. Read more at HabibHabib.com.
And now part two of Susie Larson's story.
So I met my husband at a Christian singles retreat, and we got married, and we were going to wait 5 years to have kids, but we got pregnant on our honeymoon.
Oh.
And not planning that, but God in his really profound sovereignty allowed it, because during the pregnancy, we found out I had something called endometriosis. And so they said, you will need a hysterectomy in your 20s. So you need to have your kids now or never.
Oh, wow.
And so we had Jake, and he was compliant. So we thought we were good parents, which is hilarious. But anyway, then God knew to give us Luke. And Luke, we were pregnant with Luke, and I was on bed rest for 3 months of that pregnancy. When we had Luke, Luke ended up with a number of issues. One was respiratory issues. He had immune issues, but respiratory issues were pretty significant. And I got pregnant again with Jordan, my third one. And so at 3 months along in that pregnancy, they had to sew my cervix shut and put me to bed for 6 months. So I had a 1- and a 3-year-old.
Wow.
And it was quite the challenge. And if you remember, you know, when I transferred into the kingdom of God, you know, I knew I was saved. I just didn't know I was loved. And I think a lot of Christians go through life knowing they're saved, they don't know they're loved. And when you don't know you're loved, you misuse your time, treasure, and talents to try to prove something that Jesus has already proven, right? And you get into striving. And so I just transferred all of my ambition into serving on all these committees and, you know, doing everything I could, because I was excited to be a Christian, but I was really striving in it all as well. So to go to bed and kind of be a debt and have to people bring meals very much confronted my performance, my insecurities, I mean, really emerged my insecurities in a big way. So to go to bed for 6 months was just about more than I could handle. So I've got different friends, you know, and I use up a lot of favors in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching my husband just exhaust himself. I almost couldn't bear it. I was probably 3 months into my bed rest, so I was 6 months along, feeling kind of depressed. And the doctors had said, you know, why don't you get up and test the waters and let's see how you do, because you hadn't contracted in a couple of days. And so I met my old college roommates. It was a fall day. We went for a walk. I was super careful, had lunch, but I was back on bed rest that night. Just, it was too much. And I was unknowingly bit by the deer tick. And within 2 weeks of that outing, a friend came to visit and asked where my water bottle was, and I pointed and pins and needles shot down my arm. And she kept talking, and suddenly I felt a buzzing, numbing, crawling feeling start at the base of my skull, and buzzing and pulsating numbness came around to the front of my face like a bloodsucker was on my face, just a buzzing, pulsating. And so I'm trying to listen to her going, what is going on? And at the same time, I had an athletic bent. I taught fitness classes and things. There was a gal in our church who also was our age and had an athletic bent and had severe MS. And she just, you know, spiraled down so fast. So she had a lot of tremors. And I mean, she just lost so much of her ability. So to have neurological symptoms and have 3 months to go was just so stressful. And we were just ringing up medical debt because I'm going in and out of the hospital to stop labor.
Was it just feeding fear for you?
Oh,
I mean, you talk
word.
About being a fearful person.
Oh,
with fear off the
my
charts.
Word. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend who had kind of the gift of discouragement. I don't know if you have one like that. But she came to visit and said, yeah, I guess it's personalities like yours that most often get MS. Which, you know, we both knew that gal from church. And I don't know why she said that. But when she left, I'm telling you, I never have felt a tangible sense of the demonic presence like I did in my living room. Like, I was getting backed into the couch thinking, I will not survive this. And it was just a nightmare come true, Meredith, because I would rather die than live with a debilitating disease. That's just how I felt, because after all these months of being the debt, I couldn't bear it. And to see the fatigue in my husband's eyes, it was just a nightmare come true for me. 3 months of left of pregnancy with up and down cyclical symptoms. And so then we gave birth to Jordan. And I will say, when Jordan was born, this was before I was pregnant with Luke. So about 10 months prior, Luke had a respiratory illness that put him in the hospital and he almost died. So he was 15 months old and his chest was retracting with every breath, like it was breaking. I mean, it was really terrible. He was very, very sick. And so I remember crawling up into his tent and holding on to him, and they were like, his heart may not last another 24 hours. I mean, it was terrible. So when JoJo was born, RSV was an epidemic, and doctors had said, you almost lost your toddler, not 10 months ago. So keep people out of your house that are sick. And so a friend had come with a sick child, and within a couple of days, Luke was, rasping and whatever. And they said, we don't want to put him in the hospital because you've got a newborn. This is an airborne virus. So we had a little playpen. We had a little split entry house. We put Luke in there. We put the steamer in there. They taught me how to do bronchial drainage where you pound on their lungs. And so I'd disinfect my hands, change my shirt, nurse the baby, disinfect my hands, go down and take care of Luke. Now, remember, I've got a disease in my body that I don't know what's happening. And I was not sleeping more than 2 hours a night. And if you want to give a disease a landing strip in your life, don't sleep. Mm-hmm. So I have neurological fireworks going on in my body, but I'm like, I can't think about that now. I've got to, keep these babies separate so my newborn doesn't get what Luke has. And after several weeks of really day, night, no sleep, I come in to get my little baby out of the crib, and he's rattling and coughing. And so we had our life group over, and I said to them, God must not be speaking to me. I actually think he lost my address, because I was praying and the word was dead on the page. I had no sense of his presence. I really felt like, people even would say that, like, what did you do? You must have some hidden sin in your life to go through so much. And I'm like, man, if you see something, tell me, because nobody wants out of this, like, more than
desperate.
I'm so desperate. And so our life group got around the little, carrier, the little baby seat, and laid their hands on Jordan and sang over him and prayed. And I felt the presence of God. I felt it. I'm like, we are on the cusp of a miracle. I mean, it had been so long since I had sensed his presence. It was just such a dry and weary land, And the next morning, I go get him, and his lips are blue, and he's coughing. The little four-week-old, and his little chest is doing that little retraction thing. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So we brought him into the ER. They took him out of our hands and just ran and said, follow us. They didn't even do the paperwork till later, and put him in a tent. And they put his arm in a splint, started the IV, and got the oxygen going and all that. And Kev went to call people. I'm beside myself with exhaustion. I was so tired, and my body was just doing these crazy things. And I couldn't believe this happened after how the night had gone the night before. And I sat in the rocking chair next to the crib, and I was just overcome by this just oil of joy. And I'm like, I'm either losing my mind or God is doing something here. And I wrote down, I don't know what this is, but I'll take it. Well, JoJo was in the hospital for a week. He had like a double pneumonia and some other things going on. And we got him home, and my health just went up and then down, up and down. And every time I went down, the downs were deeper.
And you had no idea what was going on?
No idea. And they thought MS, they thought brain tumor. They ruled those things out. They didn't know what was going on. And a year later, I was, and my friends had kind of gone away, lost a number of friends, because back then they didn't know a lot. I mean, Jordan is now 32, so they didn't know a lot about Lyme disease back then. And so I lost friends through it, because they're like, you're a hypochondriac. I'm like, I'm so not. I mean, I'm a fighter. I want to live. I couldn't. It was, those symptoms are so crazy with Lyme disease too. And I remember getting on my face going, God, you have to tell me, am I dying or am I living? Because I need to either start letting go or start fighting hard. And would you have someone call me to point me in the right direction? And the phone rang. And it was like the first time something breakthrough had happened. And it was a guy from our church. He's like, you still having all those symptoms? He said, turn on channel 4, whatever the channel was. He was like, I gotta go. I turn on the channel, whatever it was, and it was Sally Jesse Raphael. I don't know if you remember.
Yes.
The big red glass. Yeah. She had big red glasses. She was a talk show. And she had a panel of women with Lyme disease who were athletes. Some of them were athletes like me. And they're like, some called me a hypochondriac. Some thought I had MS. Then they thought they were telling my story. So I went in and said, test me for Lyme disease. Back then, they didn't know what they were doing, and it was, so they gave me some medicine and then pulled me off, and I'd relapse, and then they give me a little bit more medicine, then pull me off, and I'd relapse. And so there was a point where I couldn't function, and so Kev scooped me up like a rag doll and brought me into the hospital and kind of, just said, you got to help her.
Do something.
Yeah, so they put a port or whatever, shunt in my arm to start IV, and they sent me home and they said a home health care nurse will show up to your house to show you how to do this IV.
And how old were your kids at this point?
1, 3, and 5.
Oh, my God.
I mean, nightmare come true, because we'd used up all of our favors. So here's where the story gets interesting, though. I'm on this couch that I did all my bed rest on, you know, and when you grow deep and wide, as you do in pregnancy, the springs pop, you know, so I'm like, I hate this couch. I feel like all I've done has been on this couch for my, you know, and the blinds were, you know, breaking. Our house was just falling apart. And the nurse comes and she's getting me, showing us how to clean the little shunt or whatever that is. And my veins kept collapsing. And, you know, so they're like, this is how you clean it. This is how you do the IV. You're going to get worse before you get better. Little Jojo is what, a year old. He runs into the living room with his little diaper on, Speedy Gonzalez. And she goes, what is he doing alive? I'm like, what do you mean? And she goes, I've taken care of two other patients like you who were bit during the pregnancy around the same time as you, went a year undiagnosed, just like you. Both babies went blind and died. Goodness. She's like, why is he alive? Was he sick? And I said, actually, yeah, he was sick at 4 weeks old. What did they use for his treatment? I don't remember what it was, but I told her, and she said, that saved his life. You were treating his Lyme disease before you knew you had it. And I literally fell to my knees and started to weep right in front of her. And I'm like, God, I'll never shake my fist at you again. Oh, my word, you saved my son's life. Oh, my word, you know. And that oil of joy that I was feeling in the hospital, where I thought I'm either losing my mind or I'm in the middle of a miracle, that's what that was. Is he was giving me a lowercase no to give me a capital yes, right? I mean, he was saying no to the immediate. And I always say God is content to be misunderstood, you know, because we sensed his presence. He moved. And then I felt like he pulled the rug out from underneath me. But what he was doing was answering our prayers. It's just in a way that we just didn't understand at the moment. And when I look at Jordan now as a husband and a father and a son, he's hilarious and amazing. And I just marvel, you know, that God saved him. And that began a pretty significant battle for me with Lyme.
So it got worse.
Oh, yeah. Got worse before it got better. And then I probably had about, as I started to get better, I'll just throw this in there, and I don't want to just, you know, exhaust you. But my husband was diagnosed with cancer, and he got through that. And I think part of having us both be sick, me in my 20s and him in his 30s, gave us so much passion to make life count. I mean, we are very focused and very purposeful, and we don't want to mess around. We don't want to waste time. We want to live for the kingdom. We want to sow generous seeds. And it's like, and we really don't care what anybody thinks of us that way. You know, we love people. We love, but our hope is in God. And you can criticize anything you want about the way we chase after God, but we know we serve an audience of one, and we're the ones who are going to give an account someday. So that just put fire in our bones. I will say for about 20 years, I managed chronic illness with, you know, I worked in the fitness industry. I was a fitness instructor and a fitness manager for a number of years, and a trainer where I helped certify, train other instructors, and that kept the fight. So when they were telling me, you need to go to a support group for Lyme patients, I'm like, no, I'm going to go get a fitness certification. I just needed that because I still had fear issues. So to hear other horror stories only put more fear in me, but I just knew what I needed. And my brain was really messed up. The bacteria just affects your short-term memory. So I thought, I need to memorize things. I need to learn things. I just knew the path I needed to take, and that worked for me. So I taught fitness classes, but I would say five times a year I couldn't get out of bed, where I was sick for a few days just with inflammatory surges and things. But I managed it. I just managed it. And then about 6 years ago, I had a massive relapse where it affected my brain, my cognitive function, my ability to find words and spell. And it was a nightmare. And I'm working my way back from that. But my book, Fully Alive, actually came out of what happened in this last 6 years. And God, you know, there was a moment when I was getting ready to come to the radio station, and the surges were terrifying. I mean, I felt like my arms were going numb, my head was numb, my whole neck, my esophagus was spasming. Like I could feel it, twisting into a knot, like I couldn't swallow. I felt like there was a vice on my head that was being cranked. Like, I felt like, I don't know how to explain it except to say, felt like the pressure in my head felt like my skull was breaking. I can't, you know, it was just a nightmare. And I'm like, no, God, no, God, no, blood, please, 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 please. And I was trying to get ready for work, and I'd been feeling kind of the neurological symptoms flaring. And I'm thinking, this is like it normally is. I have to go to bed and I'll just be careful. And they kept escalating in that bathroom. And I'm like, no, please, not at this age, please, no, Lord. I heard the whisper, The storms reveal the lies we believe and the truths we need. And the numbing in my neck was so bad that I literally felt like the devil had me up against the wall. Mm-hmm. Like there was squeezing mm-hmm. and numbing on my neck. And I'm like, the storms reveal the lies. If you could like have been in the room and peeled back the sky, you would have seen spiritual chaos because the fear and the symptoms were a nightmare. And so I'm like, the storms reveal the lies I believe. What lies do I believe? And then I heard it in my ear, Meredith, I can get to you anytime, anywhere, and God will never stop me. And then God just roared into my heart, you have believed that your whole life. And do you know that he cannot get to you anytime? I have had him on a short leash. You do not know what I've prevented in your life. You don't even know how I've provided. I am not going to let you lose, but I have to let you fight. It feels like he has you by the throat, by the neck, but the God of peace is going to crush Satan under your feet. So rise up and fight. And I realized I'd been living, I've been fruitful. I abide in the vine. I enjoy good times with God. I was serving with a heart that loved him, but there was nipping at my heel that the shoe could drop anytime. That, you know, there was a bracing for impact in my spirit. And that's not good for any soul. And I think when you've been through enough trauma, you do live life bracing for impact. And he was like, that's the thing I want to deal with. You know, this is not true that he can get to you anytime, anywhere. And again, not going to let you lose, but I have to let you fight. And what came out of that battle was what happens in our soul happens in our cells. And so we really do need to, there's so much we stuff into the basement that we don't want to deal with. Yeah. And if you look at the Barna report that came out, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, there's virtually no difference between Christians' habits and unbelievers' habits as far as our defaults to numb out and not feel our pain, as far as addictions, the things that we turn to. You know, it could be shopping, it can be porn, it can be drugs, it can be alcohol, eating, whatever. There's no difference, at least on paper, to our capacity to numb out and not face our pain than those who don't have the Spirit of God living in them. And so if I think there's, you know, the big thrust for me in the ministry is to help people heal. I have so much compassion for the sufferer, so much compassion for those who've walked through trauma. And I think a big part of my call, whether it's through books, radio, speak, whatever it is I'm doing, is to help people walk intimately with God, to know he's their best thing, but two is to trust him for deep and profound healing, because you can't impart what you don't possess. And I think the world has been so traumatized in the last 2 years, and I've been saying on my show, we have got to heal so that we can help the world heal. That if we're walking around, you know, not willing to feel the stuff we've shoved in the basement, we're not going to be able to help other people heal. And he's a very present help in times of trouble. And he intends to restore our soul, which means to bring back, to repair, to replenish. This isn't just for heaven. He wants to show us his goodness in the land of the living. And so even though I've had to fight through a lot, I know God's word better. I know him better. I know my enemy better. And I'm better for the fight. So I'm not a victim. I'm just not. And I hate that I still have flare-ups and symptoms that I deal with pretty much every day. I hate it, and I can't wait to get my new body. I can't wait. But in the meantime, I'm not going down without a fight, because I just know God is good, and his promises are true, and he will always make a way for us. So that's who I am, and that's what I do.
You know, helping people heal, how do we do that?
You know, I had a pastor author friend on years ago, and he said, Jeff Mannion is his name, and he said, Susie, we've tried to become experts at not getting hurt, but we need to become experts at learning to heal. And I think we need to become experts at learning to heal. And I think healing looks different on all of us, but the first step is to admit you need healing. There's two types of trauma. There's a trauma, things that happened to you that shouldn't have happened. And then the other kind of trauma is things that didn't happen for you that should have happened. And we all have trauma. And if we don't deal with it, there's all this inner chaos that you're constantly trying to suppress and manage. And we become very triggerable. So if we could first just admit, you know, first of all, you're not alone. We all have trauma. We all have fractures. We're all a pile of contradictions. And if we can kind of get over ourselves and get over the sense that we need to present a certain way, get past that, because you know every one of us needs Jesus. And not only do we need him to rescue us from our sins and rescue us from the clutches of darkness, we need him to heal. By his wounds, we are healed. He was beaten so that we could be made whole. So first, turn to Jesus and say, Lord, Would you help me heal? Show me the path of healing. What does that look like? I think it includes a good counselor, a godly mentor. I'm not a self-promoter, but I do want to tell you my book, Fully Alive, is really was for that. And I have a DVD that goes with it. But I talk about shame and fear and insecurity and so many of those things that so often we're managing symptoms. And those are symptoms of unhealed areas in our lives. So I would just ask God, show me the path of healing and then go with it. Go with him there because he will lead you. And he's so good. He knows how to extract things from your soul and your story without it destroying you. And there's times once you notice, oh my goodness, this has to get dealt with. You want it done all, but you didn't get there overnight. So you don't have an infrastructure for healing if you're thinking like a sick person or thinking like, a less than person. It takes a while to renew your mind and to lean in and stand on the promises even when they don't feel true. But you know what? Life is hard. You can do hard. You've been doing hard by not paying attention and by maybe denying your hurts. So let's do hard by leaning in and saying, I'm in process. I am healing because Jesus paid for this. I'm contending for it. And you'll be amazed as you go how God really intends to heal you and is so with you. And if I could just say one more thing that I tell this story in Fully Alive, but I have a good friend who couldn't get pregnant and wanted to be pregnant so bad. And she, when she was a little girl, had some sexual trauma at the hand of a family member. Some believed her and some didn't. Now try to imagine having the trauma and then having family members question you and make you the problem for saying there's a problem. Well, she could not get pregnant, and she tried everything, and she had one more test to determine if she was a candidate for in vitro IVF. And they basically said, if you're not a candidate, this is the end of the road for you, and you either need to adopt or accept that you're not going to have children. Every time she started to go towards making that appointment, just she was triggered and fear and depression. She's like, oh, this is just stirring up so much for me. I need to go back to counseling. And years past, she had gone through counseling to work through the childhood trauma, but she's wise enough and self-aware enough to go, I'm having a disproportionate reaction to this appointment. So that's telling me something. So she went back and revisited some of the stuff that she realized that, and that's how healing goes. It's not like she didn't deal. It was just time to deal with the new layer, right, of healing. Mm-hmm. So she dealt with that and even with the potential disappointment of not being able to have kids. So she's like, I'm ready. So she made the appointment. And this is a little bit graphic, but just hang with me. But when when they put the scope in there, they found a wall of scar tissue, which verified the sexual trauma that she'd endured as a child. So the doctor's like, well, here's proof of what you said is true. And she said, I'm so sorry, first of all. But she said, I want to break through that scar tissue. She said, are you willing to do this with me? And my friend said, yeah. She goes, well, okay, hold on, because it's going to hurt. And so she took her instrument and popped through that wall of scar tissue. And on the other side of that wall of scar tissue was a perfect, viable uterus. And she says, I have the feeling you're going to come back in a month and tell me you're pregnant. And that's what happened. And I think that's such an incredible visual, because when we start to step towards healing, there's a wall of scar tissue and the enemy likes it that way. And when we bump into that, now maybe like it looks like for you, you're going to step out for a promotion. You're stepping out to write a book. You're stepping out into some new venture and all the walls come up. You're triggered to old fears. The enemy threatens to expose you, or he threatens to say, that thing about you back then, it's going to come back to haunt you. And that's the wall of scar tissue. And what do? We make a U-turn and go, can't get through. I can't get there from here. I would submit to you, picture it like a banner on a football field and blow through that thing, because on the other side of it is viable promised land. And I'm telling you, the enemy's threat to you is very connected to your threat to him. And as you dare to go, you know what? Nothing can stop the love of God. Nothing can separate me from the love of God. And there is a day where I am going to give an account for all that he entrusted to me. I cannot let scar tissue keep me from the promised land on the other side of it. And I think when you step into those things, when you bust through and do that hard work and you see the promised land on the other side, you'll just be so glad you trusted him.
Maybe as you're listening to Susie, you recognize that there are some places of hurts or wounds from your past that have kept you from what she refers to as the promised land. She mentioned a book that she's written about this called Fully Alive. I would love for you to have a copy of that.
You can enter for a chance to win this week on the Unfolding Podcast Facebook page. And if you want to know more about Susie's books, speaking engagements, her show on Faith Radio, head to susielarson.com. While you're there, you can sign up to receive her devotionals, her daily blessing emails, and more. We're so grateful to Susie for sharing her story. Thanks to the team that helps make this podcast possible. Jason Rackow, our most excellent producer, Danielle Perez, Elena Nallen, and thanks to our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. Find out how to unleash the full power of your leadership potential at HabibHabib.com. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll be back next week with another page in The Unfolding.